Chapter 17, Opposition and Expansion. With the increasingly successful outreach of the Ministry of Healing and the Word came increasingly determined resistance from the religious opposition in the community. We have had and are still having a good deal of opposition from the Arias. Several times I have been warned to be careful not to eat anything from their houses, as they had declared their determination to get rid of us somehow, and one was reported to have said that both our school and hospital should be closed before autumn. So Dr. Brown realized that her life was in constant danger because of her insistence on daily preaching the gospel and seeking to lead every patient to Christ. However, her prayers were not for her own safety, but for an effective witness in the face of the opposition. It is certain that we shall need your support in prayer much through the coming winter, that the women may not be hindered from coming where they can hear of Christ. As a means to this end, too, we do need help for the hospital, that all the work may be of the very best, and that we may not be obliged to leave undone things which might help the patients because we cannot afford the expense of the treatment. In writing to her family in England, Edith Brown analyzed the cause of the difficulties. I think this opposition is the result of several factors. One, the anger of the men at the effect that the gospel has on the hearts of the women. In one of their papers recently, they wrote urging that the Arias should start their own hospitals, as the hospitals and dispensaries are the most effective weapons that Christians had for conquering the hearts of the women. Two, it seems to be part of the general state of unrest and of opposition to everything Western. Three, an additional factor here, just at present, is that we were recently obliged to give evidence against a woman in a case of suspected poisoning, and it happened that the woman was a rich Arya who had given some thousands of rupees for an Arya girls' school. The Arias say they had collected 2 lakhs, or 200,000 rupees, to start a hospital of their own in Ludhiana. It remains to be seen how much this is true. In spite of this pressure, our patients number even more than last year. The Arias were members of the Arya Samaj, a militant Hindu group who sought to rid that religion of many of the accretions of popular Hinduism and take it back to the Vedic teachings. They wish to establish India as the homeland and holy land of all Hindus, with all other religions removed from the scene. Edith Brown was well acquainted with their teachings and knew what to anticipate in the way of opposition, but always she rejoiced in each opportunity of testing when she was able to uphold the validity of the gospel of Christ. Religious opposition was not the only difficulty to be encountered. There were also the ravages of nature, incompetence, prejudice, and ignorance. Edith poured out her heart about them all. I wonder whether English nurses can imagine the trials of a dust storm on operation day. Everything is ready and beautifully clean. The air blows hot with much dust in it. Gradually, the air becomes oppressive, and a semi-darkness clouds the land so that it becomes the half-true world of an old-fashioned sepia print. Inside the operating room, all is ready, when suddenly, without warning, bang goes one window and then another. In a moment, the air is thick with dust, so thick that sometimes it looks like a London fog. Before there is time to close the windows, everything is covered with dust, and indeed, dust seems to get through closed windows, too, for in India, neither windows nor doors appear to think of closing tightly. If they fitted well in the dry season, they would not close in the monsoons. How often patients' prejudices have to be considered in hospital treatment. A woman may refuse to have her hair washed or an operation done on a certain day, as it is an unlucky day, and the date has to be altered. She may object to the color of the clothing offered, and it has to be changed. White is disliked as the color for widows, and as rendering it much easier for them to be attacked by evil spirits. So all are dressed in colored garments. A strict Muslim may object to having her ears arranged before sundown during Ramzan, and arrangements have to be made for her medicines to be given by night instead of by day. We have as cook a Brahmin woman who carries the food around to the patients, a nurse accompanying her to see that the right quantity and kind are given in each case. But the nurse must not touch it, nor let her shadow fall on it, nor touch the cook's clothing as she is carrying it. Otherwise, the food would be defiled. As regards the cooking of the food, how one admires the large, clean kitchens of the home hospitals. Here, the cook tucks up her skirt and squats on her heels, cooking the food in large iron or copper pots over a wood fire. We may look from a distance, but our shadow must not fall on the food, and if one foot touched the sacred enclosure, it would have to be replastered with mud before it could be used again. Dr. Mary Roberts from Canada, a newcomer to the staff in 1912, recorded her first impressions of this yielding to custom and usage. Each patient is clothed according to her own individual taste, and though most of them consent to wear hospital clothes, the odd effect as one looks along the veranda is striking. If the patient has children, she brings them with her to the hospital, and they are to be seen sitting on the floor beside the beds in the midst of a miscellaneous assortment of cooking utensils and supplies, for in the Hindu ward especially, many of the patients have their food prepared by relatives who camp out in the compound and do the cooking over their little charcoal stoves. But the interpretation of all this is that the patients must be allowed to live pretty much in their own free and easy way, or they would be utterly unhappy. Rigid rules would mean empty beds, and one soon sees the wisdom of giving them such absolute freedom. For though I never saw a hospital half so untidy, neither have I seen patients more happy and contented. Most of them are genuinely grateful for what is done for them, and if anyone doubts the value of medical missions, they should go with the Barimi Sahib as she makes her rounds. Everywhere she is met by beaming smiles and a chorus of salams. One need go no farther to see that physical healing is the best way to win the people's hearts. Dr. Brown also observed some of the traditional methods used by the Hakim, or Muslim doctor. When he entered the room, a sheet was held up to separate him from the patient. He could feel her pulse with four fingers and declare this was enough for him to diagnose the case. He explained that the first finger told him the state of the heart, the second the state of the liver, the third the amount of body heat, and the fourth the state of the digestive system. At no time could he see or otherwise examine the patient. But all was not opposition and difficulty. There were many heartening episodes, too. In the spring of 1914, Dr. Brown was granted a furlough which enabled her to make an extended tour through the British Isles and also visits to Canada and the United States. Here she addressed large audiences, particularly in Toronto and Philadelphia, seeking to find new channels of support for the work. A special appeal was made to the United States, since Great Britain and other countries were beginning to feel the stress of World War I. As the train slowly pulled into the Ludhiana station on December 8, 1914, the yelling coolies and the general commotion usually associated with the approach of the train quickly made Edith Brown realize she was home. She lowered the window and poked her head out to see if by any chance someone had come down to meet her at the early hour of 5:30 a.m. But this just couldn't be. Her eyes must be deceiving her. Yet it was true. On the platform, dimly lighted by the flickering oil lamps, stood many of the staff, students, and Christian community. She wondered whether anyone was left back at the hospital to take care of the patients. When the train finally ground to a halt, the door was pulled open by a group of coolies anxious to carry her baggage, while many other hands reached up to help her down from the train. A profusion of heavily scented garlands were hung around her neck, and bouquets of roses and other flowers were thrust into her hands. Even tea had been provided at the station. It was a royal welcome indeed, but still more was to come. On leaving the station, Dr. Brown looked on every side for her own rickshaw or tonga, but neither seemed to be in evidence. This was indeed strange, as her rickshaw servant was very faithful. Then, to her astonishment, a gaily caparisoned elephant was led before her, and she was asked to mount. In truly regal style, she was escorted through the town, preceded by fireworks and surrounded by a large group of friends. At one point along the way, a banner had been stretched across the road, loudly proclaiming, "Welcome, Dr. Brown! Hip, hip, hooray!" As they passed the Memorial Hospital, Dr. Brown saw that it had been brightly illuminated and carried a huge welcome sign. The night nurses came out to give their greetings from the steps, and a group of exuberant patients joined in from the rooftop. On entering the college gates, the students quickly formed into two welcoming lines and burst into a hymn of praise and thanksgiving. It was a real joy to be home. Next morning, the routine of work began without delay. Dr. Ruth Wilson, who had been acting principal, was seriously ill with typhoid fever, as were also Sister Gourlay and Sister Jones. The remaining staff had carried on under exceptionally difficult circumstances and had proved the promise of Scripture that they could run and not be weary, walk and not faint. Work had moved along successfully, and financial support had been strengthened. The American United Presbyterian Mission, the American Presbyterian Mission, and the Canadian Presbyterian Mission, all of whom had been early supporters, were joined in 1912 by the American Methodist Episcopal Mission, who had voted to give an annual grant of 600 rupees for maintenance as well as scholarship assistance for any of their students who were in the school. A new relationship with the government was announced by Sir Michael O'Dwyer, Lieutenant Governor of Punjab, in a speech at the prize distribution of the Lahore Medical College, reported in the Civil and Military Gazette, December 25, 1913. The question of providing means for bringing medical relief to the women of India is one that has always been present to the minds of Englishmen, and especially to English women in this country. I need only instance the efforts of Lady Dufferin, Lady Minto, and Lady Hardung. Ultimate success lies not so much in the building of hospitals as in training Indian women to take up the medical profession or the profession of nursing. Our efforts to attract female students to Lahore have failed. We offered them accommodation, we offered them scholarship and the possibility of a career. Our efforts were in vain, mainly, as the principal has told us, owing to the disinclination of the female students to follow the same lectures and demonstrations as the men. We have to accept and defer to that feeling, and I am now glad to be able to announce that it has been decided to recognize on certain conditions the Ludhiana Medical School as the provincial school for women. In January 1914, news was received from the Punjab government of the recognition of the Ludhiana Medical College as the provincial training school for women qualifying for a medical career. At the same time, the announcement was made of the increase in the government's annual grant in aid to 34,000 rupees toward budget expenditure and a special building grant of 25,000 rupees for improvements in the hospital. This important development did not happen by chance. It was clear that Dr. Brown had labored in this direction for some time, as revealed in a later speech by Sir Michael O'Dwyer. When I became Lieutenant Governor of Punjab, I was warned by my financial secretary against being too generous in responding to appeals. Two very capable ladies, I was told, were especially dangerous in this matter, and I must be on my guard against them, for each would make out a good case for government aid. And if they did, the provincial finances might be depleted to the extent of 5 or even 10,000 rupees. I therefore tried to adopt the rule of a hard-hearted financial cerebrus, but my defeat came in the Christmas week of 1913 at the hands of Dr. Edith Brown of Ludhiana, one of the very women against whom I had especially been warned. As a result of a 2-hour interview when the great scheme of expanding the Women's Christian Medical College into the Punjab Women's Medical School was involved, Dr. Edith Brown, who had come into my office with a government grant of 15,000 rupees per annum, left with a promised grant of 42,000 rupees. No living person, man or woman, but Dr. Edith Brown could have got so much out of me in such a short time. She got it because she was able to convince me that the money would be well spent for the benefit of Punjab and all classes in it, without distinction of class or creed. This greater cooperation with the government necessitated another change in the medical school's constitution. On its 21st anniversary in 1915, the name of the college was enlarged to the Women's Christian Medical College, with which is incorporated the Punjab Medical School for Women. Another period of building activity ensued. With the help of the government, a portion of the adjoining jail garden was secured, thus enabling the construction of the sisters' home, nurses' quarters, cookhouse, and dining room for non-Christian students. Six new wards were constructed, and the other rooms converted into private wards, making a total of 30 private wards. Also started were new medical wards and an operating theater for septic cases. A long-cherished dream of Dr. Brown was to have a college chapel where Bible study and prayers could be held daily, as well as special services and other college assemblies. It was significant that, at the time the school was opened to students of all faiths, the chapel, which would be a continual reminder of the Christian nature of the institution, became a possibility. First funds for it were raised in 1913 by Dr. Ruth Wilson during her furlough. The balance of the needed amount was given in 1916 by Mrs. R. McWorth Wilson of Dublin in memory of her husband. This couple had given £500 in 1901 for the construction of the first operating room. Built at the entrance to the college compound, the chapel is austere and unadorned, standing as an example of brethren simplicity. Here, Dr. Brown led college prayers and Bible study, taking the girls through the Bible, book by book, asking questions and receiving answers. In this modest hall, the foundation and groundwork for all the other activities of the institution was surely and firmly laid.